You're listening to The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we're missing television's Daniel Freeb this week, but we are joined by Ned Bolting.
Hello, Richard.
Hi, Ned.
Hello.
It's been a while.
Yes, podcasting's Richard Moore. It has.
Maybe about a year.
Possibly, yeah. I can't remember that. I dropped in on during the
you
Tour de France.
You made a cameo during the Tour de France. I think that Montpellier, wasn't it? It was a crosswind
when
stage.
The wind blew.
Peter Sagan, Chris Froome, Geraint Thomas.
All that.
Yeah,
and Sagan was going to gift the stage to his teammates who didn't, and then Chris Froome didn't realise that Bodnar, was it Bodnar?
Bodnar.
And Chris Froome didn't really realise the kind of etiquette of that because he doesn't really get cycling.
He
Chris
hasn't really followed it for long, has
he? Doesn't follow the Tour de France.
He's not steeped in
history. So he went and sort of like turned it into a race, and Sagan went, oh, well, if we're going to do that, then I'll have to win. What a year he's had.
Terrible.
What a year you lot have had. I pick up the Evening Standard, and there you are, being quoted in the mainstream media.
Well, we should explain that we're talking a couple of weeks ago.
How did the Telegraph feel about that?
We're talking a couple of weeks ago. We're speaking to Ned on the eve of his nationwide tour, which is, to quote, probably a live, spectacular theatrical event all about bicycles.
Yeah, I don't know who put the word spectacular in. At one point, I use a prop.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've had some props built that I've yet to see because we're recording this on the eve of the tour starting, I have to say. So I'm a bit worried about knowing my lines. So I have got several props, but I can't give them away. They're central to the way that the plot of the evening unfolds.
Wow.
I will say, though, that two bicycle components are brought onto the stage, one of which is hashtag iconic.
Well, that's why it deserves the spectacular in the title and
that's
the description.
Why.
It's called Bicology, Ned. Ned Bolting's Bicology is the title of the tour. Why not Tour de Ned? That strikes me as
that's
the Tour de Ned.
If you were to come, as I believe you will do, to the show and purchase a program, you will find the words Tour de Ned being used. So
anyway, we'll get on to the
good.
Talking about the live spectacular theatrical event. This is the week of your grand départ. It
might
starts
be as much
this
as a fiver,
week,
don't
so you'll be. Anyway, we'll get onto that in a moment.
Well, just hang
before
on.
Before that, can we do the news roundup
of
first,
course.
Please? We want
to
know what's actually been going on.
Let's find out.
Lionel, over to you.
I'll get my crystal ball out and do the news roundup in the future, in the past.
Wow! And if your mind isn't blown by that, it will be by this.
Thank you from the past. This is the present, and some of the latest news in professional cycling. At the London 6 Day, Belgians Kenny de Ketteler and Moreno de Pau successfully defended their title, dramatically gaining a lap late in the final Madison and clinching an 11-point victory over Bradley Wiggins and Mark Cavendish. Next on the circuit is the Ghent 6 Day, where Wiggins and Cavendish will team up again. Now, that was supposed to be Wiggins' final race as a professional, but during the podium ceremony in London, he hinted that he might continue his career into 2017. To cyclocross and the European Championships, Toon Aerts of Belgium was a surprise winner of the men's title in Pontchâteau in France. He beat the two pre-race favourites Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert into second and third place. Dalita de Jong of the Netherlands won the women's race, adding the European Championships to her world title, but it was a race to forget for two British riders. Right at the start, Helen Wyman hit Nikki Bramier's rear wheel going into the first corner and both riders went down. Wyman broke her collarbone and Bramier needed several stitches to her face. After an investigation into sexism, British Cycling has upheld track sprinter Jess Varnish's claims that Shane Sutton used inappropriate and discriminatory language towards her. Sutton continues to deny that he told Varnish to go and have a baby after she was dropped from British Cycling's Olympic programme. He had resigned as technical director of British Cycling and until last week had been hopeful that there'd be a way back for him. In an interview with Sky Sports, he said that there had been a conversation with Varnish about her weight and admitted he had said she needed to lose some timber. Sutton is now looking for alternative employment in cycling and says he has a few irons in the fire. Varnish welcomed the verdict, saying in a statement, "I spoke out because I wanted to shine a light on the culture at British Cycling, a culture that in my mind was incorrect." Meanwhile, MPs are set to pose questions about Bradley Wiggins, Team Sky and the medical package couriered by the then BC employee Simon Cope to Sky's Dr. Richard Freeman at the end of the 2011 Dauphiné. A Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee is expected to meet at the end of November, and several key figures could be called to answer questions. There's a few high-profile transfers to confirm. Sky have signed the Italian Diego Rosa from Astana and Frenchman Kenny Ellison from FDJ, bolstering their climbing options. And Heinrich Hausler, who was runner-up in the 2009 Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix and was riding for IM Cycling before they folded, has joined Bahrain Merida. Finally, the 1986 world champion Moreno Argentine has been jailed for a year for mortgage fraud, according to La Gazzetta dello Sport. And 2002 Vuelta winner Aitor Gonzalez has been arrested, suspected of being involved in a robbery at a mobile phone store in Alicante in Spain. Finally, just a mention for our sponsors Eurosport, who will be showing the UCI Track Cycling World Cup from Glasgow this weekend. That's the opening round of this winter's World Cup series. Starts on Friday, November the 4th at 7 p.m. with live coverage continuing on Saturday at 7 p.m. and on Sunday at 2. Now back to the past again.
Thanks for that, Lionel.
No problem, Richard. Back here in the present, which is also the past.
It's nice that Bob got a win though, isn't it?
yeah, indeed. Talking about Ned Bolting's Bikeology Tour, it's very much a tour of Britain. Some horrendous transfers here between stages. Ned, Bury St Edmunds, then Chelmsford, then Yeovil, then Portsmouth, then Leeds.
Has Mick Bennett saying this?
Who's put this together?
There will be some complaints, you're right. Sore limbs and that. I'm going to ride from Bury St Edmunds to Chelmsford on Thursday morning. I think that's the only one I can do by bike.
Quite a few rest days as well. So a few rest days, yeah. It's a bit sporadic schedule, but a lot of dates there. How many is it in total? 15, 16?
12, 14, something like that. I genuinely don't know.
But nothing in Scotland.
No, and there's been Tour of Britain-esque complaints about that, and all Wales.
Complaints? Are you sure about that?
Complaints. Complaints.
It was not in response to requests. there is no date in Scotland.
It's actually amazing that you put out a tour and instantly you get people who feel snubbed that you're not, you know, whatever.
But it finishes in London at the Clapham Grand and I'll be there.
Clapham Grand, which someone described to me, I had never been to the Clapham Grand, but someone, I was at a posh cycling event a couple of weeks ago and someone came out and said, I'm coming to your thing in a few weeks at the Clapham Grand. I have to say it's a bit chavvy. And I went, all right. See you there then.
I think it's a nightclub, is it not?
Yeah, ordinarily. Mostly a nightclub. But for one night only, it'll be turned into a cauldron of cycling thing.
Cauldron of cycling
thing.
Well, we are going to talk about that. I mean, we're gonna quiz you on other things while you're here, Ned. Yeah. I mean, you're a fully fledged commentator now.
Yeah.
We'll get onto that in part two, and you've certainly covered a lot of races this year that you've never been to before, yeah. And you were obviously at the Giro, you were at the Tour, and the Vuelta, and you've done a lot of kind of very obscure races as well. So let's speak to you about that in part two. But tell us about this tour. You've got a book out as well, the Velosaurus. There's no connection
There's no connection except a pure coincidence of time. The tour is kind of divided into two halves, literally and thematically. Right, so it's an evening with an interval. Theatres like intervals, so they can flog wine and stuff. And I quite like the idea of coming into the second half a little bit tipsy as well. It might make my job a bit easier. But the first half is an opportunity for me to bite the hand that feeds me a little. And as you know, and I think you know, Lionel, I have kind of certain take on the cycling community. I'm a technical numpty. I'm not interested in technical stuff and how bikes work. I have certain kind of reservations about the way we're headed as a cycling culture in the United Kingdom that I believe you probably share to a certain extent. And I like poking fun at people, and it's an opportunity to poke fun at myself, but also just generally kind of amongst friends, analyse our peculiarities, our eccentricities, and the things that make us both wonderful, but also a little bit risible as well. And the second half, I turn my attention much more to 15 years or whatever it is of the Tour de France. And what's been interesting is I've trawled back through the video archive back to 2003 and stuff like that. Got an amazing interview with a very young David Miller, pre-doping ban, recorded in 2003, where I actually remembered an interview where I kind of like sidle up to him and he's just had one of his epically horrible days on a bike. And he's giving it the full, he's got the beanie hat on, the full attitude, and he's kind of slouching around like Kevin the teenager. And that has to be seen to be believed. And I run that clip to the audience in the theatre on a screen, and then I show a little video I shot this summer of David Miller watching that video and his sort of like I was going to say teenage self, but that's how he comes across. And you know, the contrast between this kind of posh Maserati-driven elder statesman that he's become now and that precocious twerp that he was.
But the 2003 tour was your first, and that was also the famous one of the yellow jumper, because it was it was in an interview with Miller where you'd let that slip that he was disappointed not to
talking about David
jumper.
Miller de-chaining on the prologue that I referred to the yellow jumper.
But what about, I mean, apart from the way that Miller has changed, what about you, Ned? I mean, when you look back at some of that old footage of you arriving at the tour as a green...
That 10 kilos lighter. Literally.
Now?
You are
I am now. Yeah. Because I slipped into my mid-30s and, you know, unbeknownst to me, I'd kind of start to thicken out in the way that people do. And I certainly didn't ride a bike. And I came back from that tour and thought, this is how infantile my thinking is. God. Cycling's quite good, isn't it? Maybe I better get a bike. So I went down to Halfords and bought a mountain bike for 80 quid, and that's what put me on a bike. But do you know what? As weird as that sounds, I genuinely think that a lot of people at the same time were making the same connection between watching Lance Armstrong fall on Lazare du Den and going to Halfords. It's nuts, isn't it? But you know, there aren't many other sports that have done that.
I mean, that you're right. I mean, that was such an exciting tour, such a good first tour to cover, and I suspect that it was around that time, it was Lance Armstrong's fifth tour win.
Yep.
It was around the time the Armstrong story was starting to really
get some
transcend
traction.
Beyond well beyond cycling and pick up followers from, you know, other sports, so on, and it's probably the start of that huge community of cycling beginning to really grow here in the UK.
It's hard to remember quite what that was like. Lionel, were you out on the road on that tour? I mean, the scale of the interest in Armstrong, his charisma, the attention he attracted, and everything that surrounded him blew me away. Actually, I wasn't prepared for quite the superstar that he was back then and the fuss that surrounded him. And when I think back, with everything that we know now and kind of almost knew a little bit at the time, the one thing you have to say is I can't unenjoy that tour. I can't sort of unpick the fact that it was absolutely beguiling as an introduction to the sport. It was totally fascinating from start to finish.
Well, that was in my brief hiatus away from covering cycling, so I kind of missed the middle Armstrong years. I for once witnessed the first three and then the last one in 2005.
There's a connection there, I think. You did all the boring. I think it was following those tours that sort of drove you away,
it was really, yeah. I was fed up by just the fact that the cult of Lance Armstrong kept getting bigger and bigger, and there was such a whiff around it all, even in 2001, that I'd had enough, really, and thought that was me and covering cycling done. When I came back in 2005 and I did a few days on that tour, what struck me was just how enormous he was by that stage. I mean, it was
a bit like Ned.
Completely, you know, in the gap between 2001, where he was, you know, he was just starting to lengthen his stride in a way, wasn't he? Yeah, sort of marching around the tour, you know, as if he owned the place. By 2005, he certainly did. And, you know, his sort of defiant farewell on the podium, when he said, you know, he was sad for anyone who couldn't believe in this wonderful spectacle and believe in the great champions alongside him, who were Jan Ullrich and Ivan Basso. Of course, they were all heroes with feet of clay, weren't they? You know, it was. But Armstrong had become enormous by that stage, and the Tour de France really was the Tour de Lance by 2005. And it was almost like pressing the reset button in 2006, wasn't it? Suddenly it felt much smaller.
Pressing some sort of button anyway, wasn't it? It was the ejector button, possibly.
It felt small and less significant, and it felt like it diminished. Might, with the Operation Puerto scandal in 2006, there was this sense that, you know, had Armstrong been there, none of this would have blown up. The lid would have been kept very solidly on it. But because there was no imposing, strong character on the tour, it just shattered apart, didn't it?
Do you know, the other thing, going back through the archives and, you know, preparing for the Bikeology Tour, the video that struck me was there was, I can't remember if it's 2004 or 5, but there was a stage early on in that tour in the Vosges Mountains where Armstrong got isolated, I think on the Ballon d'Alsace. Yeah? So yeah. You're nodding like you remember that. And we were screaming at the television saying, attack him, one of you, like Basso and, you know, Ulrich, do something. When are you ever going to get that? And no one did, of course. And then I interviewed Armstrong at the end of that stage and pushed him quite hard on, and I found this tape, pushed him quite hard on where were your team, what went wrong and all this sort of thing. And he's smart. I said, how are you going to put it right? And he smiles at me and he says, that's a very good question. And then he kind of looks down and he smiles, quite clearly smiles, and he goes, I got a pretty good idea of how to put things right. And of course, we now know with hindsight, you know, having read the autobiography, exactly what he did. But the fact that he could thought he could just smirk in front of a live camera as he envisaged the massive industrial doping his team was about to undertake is absolutely
remember that clearly. It was Peter Weening, I think, won the stage ahead of Andreas Klöden. Got away
by millimeters.
What's that?
By very, very close.
Very
margin,
close.
Wasn't
but
it?
Yeah, it was Klöden that got away, who was perhaps because he was also.
It was that triumvirate of T-Mobile.
Yeah, Vinokurov was there. And yeah, it was a missed opportunity, felt. But then, you know, with a massive blood transfusion.
The very next summit finished. I don't know if it was the next day or the next but one. They
finished
the
rest day.
Nine of them, wasn't it? It was like they were all there.
Yeah, amazing. Remarkable. So you show some of this footage in the show. And I guess, to look back on that.
It's like videotape is a very strange thing, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it looks quite bland. It's not filmic. It kind of looks quite ordinary. But with the passage of time, very quickly, it acquires a kind of vintage. And nostalgia kicks in surprisingly early. So even when you look back, even though 2003 still seems to me like relatively recent, it isn't, you know. And the kit is different. The colours are somehow different. Everything is just sufficiently different enough for you to go, it kind of takes your breath away, actually.
Yeah,
straight away you're in that
you're
world.
Nostalgic
again,
you know. Almost already. It does happen remarkably quickly. I'm looking at old footage of the 2012 tour the other day, and you know already
the Adidas Adidas kit just looks dated.
It does look dated. I mean, it's the fact that you've been able to, and we've done live events before. You know, three of us or two of us sitting chatting in front of an audience. I guess it's basically a stand-up show that you've created. Is a logical sort of progression from that, evolution of that.
We talked about it, didn't we? I mean, there's a lot of demand for, I think, you know, people to be in a kind of theatre.
The live event.
The live event. And it was, I suppose it was formalising the kind of events that us three have taken part in, I've done on my own quite often, and turning that into a thing. It wasn't actually my idea. Some producers came and approached me about it said, you know, sooner or later someone's going to do one about cycling, it might as well be you. You'd be irritated if it wasn't.
What does that say about the way that cycling culture in the UK has grown and developed, not just grown, but developed, that you can create a show that is it's a comedy. Mm. It's a comedy show, isn't it? Mm. That you know, it's not just
I hesitate to call it stand-up, but I want people to laugh and enjoy themselves.
But when you start doing the events, they are informative. They're giving people insight into what it's like to be at the races, the riders, etc. So for that to develop into something that you can make comedy out of, what does that say about the way the culture's developed?
I think it says something about... I think what it does do is it says something about the nature of this particular sport that we still, I hope, love. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing the podcast and the job you're doing. That it is such a hard sport to approach as an outsider, and such a hard lock to unpick, and such a hard code to crack. But when you do get to that point of release, it's hugely rewarding, and you just want, and it kind of drives this thirst to want more and more and more, you know. And I think that's what it is. And that's maybe a peculiarly British story and a very recent story. But there's, you know, what it does say is there's a lot of demand and not enough supply still, you know. People want to sit down and talk, you know. There'd be lots and lots and lots of your many, many podcast listeners could think of nothing better than spending Tuesday afternoon sitting in where we are, just chewing the cud and talking in the way that we're talking.
We'll maybe come to this more in the third part, but do you get the sense that is the demand still going up and up, or do you see a levelling off?
Others are less than...
Do you see a levelling off?
What's quite interesting is, and I remember, well, I used to work exclusively for ITV for my broadcast work, and I remember the previous head of ITV telling me that people should never forget at ITV that there's a very northern bias to ITV's viewing figures. It's quite a northern channel. That's where a lot of its core fan base is. And I think cycling's a bit like that, actually. So I know from feedback from the ticket sales and the venues that are always hard to sell tickets in London, relatively. And we've done events in London, haven't we? They've been less than well attended. But the further, you know, if you go, the real... So what I've discovered is the heartlands are Lancashire and Yorkshire. And to a certain extent, you know, other counties around there. But the North West and Yorkshire are just insane with the way it's taken off there.
And yet, I think in London especially, we're very struck by how popular it is among you know, people who are earning lots of money, etc. That's the impression, certainly, that's been the big growth in the sort of quite well-off cyclists. But I think you're right that, you know, still in those heartlands, which have always been there, actually, always, there's been a real a real resurgence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people focus on the new golf thing and the City Gents and all that, but maybe just because they events often get wrapped around marketing targeted at them, and perhaps because of who they are and the influences they bring to bear in the media, they make more noise as cycling fans and get more attention than others. But I think that they are the crust on the top. I think that there's, you know, I think that cycling is possibly a little bit more democratic than we give it credit for, actually, often.
Any reason you're not going back to Dublin, Ned, after our very successful
How
event?
How many
that
people
we did.
Did we have in Dublin? Were you there, Richard? I was with Tim Moore, wasn't it, on that occasion?
No,
yeah.
It's just you two.
I was there, yeah. He's Lionel, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, what did I call you?
Richard.
Just Richard, but...
You guys
we're
are just
similar.
Morphing into
there
a...
Were, there, was a people, there were about 15 people there, I think, weren't there?
There were less than that. I'd say 10.
There were more people on stage.
Oh, that was hard, wasn't it? That was hard. And we've been flown over there by the Dublin Literature Festival and put up in a beautiful hotel, as far as I remember, in central Dublin.
The event was a huge, big venue, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That was some.
Don't dwell on the negatives.
But
there have
been lots of good events as well. Let's hear a little bit more from Ned's show now.
You know, every morning I ride out at the famous every Wednesday morning. It's a bit of exaggerating, isn't it? I ride up to Herne Hill Velodrome, the famous old two-time Olympic venue in South London. I'm in the old man section, you just go round and round in circles. And I've got a bike down there, and I enjoy my couple of hours of exercise. And a couple of weeks ago, right, I have a track bike, and track bikes, there's nothing simpler than a track bike. It's just pedals and wheels and a frame. Anyway, I'm minding my business, warming up, going around the track, and I notice that this guy is ghosted up alongside me. He's just riding along. I've never met him before. And he was one of those guys, I don't want to do it that way, but I'm going to. he was riding an immaculately restored, vintage, pristine bike with all the steel lugs and things like that. And he spent every waking hour polishing and buffing this thing. And my bike isn't one of them, right? It's not impressive. And he ran up alongside me, and he wanted to make conversation with me. And by the way, did I mention he had a slightly irritating beard? he's one of those guys. I don't know his name, but let's call him Benji. So Benji clearly wanted to make conversation with me, and his opening gambit was this. He said to me, "For me, it all starts with a hug." That was the first thing he ever said to me. Oh, by the way, that's not actually Benji, that's just... I went into Google Images and put irritating cyclists with a beard. That's nothing like that. So, that's a very difficult question to ask. You know, what do I say next? For me, it all starts with a hug. I could have said, damn right, for me too. But then, you know, that would have implied that we were sort of brethren of the hub. For me, I could have said, not for me, mate, start to the bottom bracket. You would seem to be bluff. But worst of all, and this is an absolute sin in the cycling world, I could have had no opinion whatsoever. You know, that is the one thing you can't do. That's the kind of thing that gets you blackballed at the AGM. Or, you know, if the UCI get involved, you get docked 30 seconds and handed a 300 Swiss franc fine for having no opinion about hubs.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Very grateful to them for their support.
Home of cycling.
Home of cycling, yes. Hashtag home of cycling. Thanks for that, Ned. That will be made into a little Eurosport advert for next year. Now, you were mentioning, Ned, in the little break there. That
you nearly called me Ed then, didn't you?
Ned, you were mentioning.
Catching.
Jed. You were mentioning.
What's your Starbucks name, by the way? Have you got a Starbucks name?
Richard.
Is it? Always?
Yeah, I'm not a good enough liar to pretend that my name's something else.
I always get Lionel, Lynal. So yeah. I normally go with Tour de France riders. I'm often Bernard.
Really?
Or Watford players.
Yeah.
I've been Luther. Wilf.
Wilf. You're not a Luther, Lionel. Sorry.
I've been Wilf, but Wilf Rostron. Any
thought
fans
I had
of 80
the easiest Watford. Name you could possibly, you know, how could you get Ned wrong? And yet, yeah. Nine times out of ten, it's
not even your real name, is
Ben
it?
Or, yeah, it's close enough to being my real name.
Ned? I can't remember.
Just move on.
Had this discussion before.
Did you have to change it for equity reasons, your name?
Because you're going back, you're completing the circle here, going back to your roots. You were
a hopeless actor.
And now you're you know, back on the stage in the bright lights. Now, you mentioned in the break there that you're forcing members of the audience. This might put off people who've bought tickets.
It's entirely voluntary.
Okay, to take the bicology oath. Right. Why does that go?
What's frightening is how willing people are to do it.
Oh, you always get.
But then we know, you know, on the evidence of referendum.
But what is the bicology oath?
The bicology oath. Well, Lionel alluded to it earlier. It is the words of a certain bicycle rider on his retirement speech on the Champs-Élysées.
Do you have to do it in the voice of the controversial Lance Armstrong?
You have to, kind of 1,000-yard stare and a mild Texan accent.
I'm sorry, I don't believe in miracles.
That's really good. I like that.
That was very good, yeah.
I like that. Almost like Lance is sitting here, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Ned, I'm sure the tour is, I can't wait to see it. It's really the highlight of my November social calendar.
Blimey.
Clap them. Bring it on. Yeah, that's pretty much November, yeah. Ned, this year you dipped your toes in the commentary waters last year, 2015. This year you've become a fully fledged commentator. You did the Tour de France for the first time for ITV, but you did a lot of other races as well. I mean, you've been on the road a lot this year.
I have. I've done surprising little races, and it's been a lot of fun. I have to say, the first race I commentated on in 2016 wasn't necessarily the best experience. That's the Dubai Tour. Which is a stinker, really, let's be honest. That's a gig I won't get back.
there goes that one. But were you, I mean, you were doing so many races. Was it just to practice? And to help with rider identification and so on?
So, I mean, I think it's kind of, generally speaking, like, if you're not immersed in a certain job, it's kind of hard to understand the nuances within that job. And I think people from the outside quite understandably think that all broadcasting jobs are sort of interchangeable and it's just telly, isn't it? But actually, it's not. And there's a world of difference between reporting or presenting and commentating. To my mind, might be in the same environment, but they are completely different jobs. So I just figured the more miles I could get under the belt before stepping up with David and doing the ITV Tour de France commentary, which of course is a hugely different audience and a much, much bigger audience than anything else you'll ever do on the calendar.
And huge shoes to fill, because you and David Miller obviously replaced Phil Liggett and Paul Shorter. Now, Phil Liggett's been the voice for cycling since the mid-80s. I think you were probably quite apprehensive about, I mean, having you've done lots of commentary, but you know, being the main commentator at the Tour de France is a whole different
proposition. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I mean, I think we probably were. We didn't like to admit it, but we were briefed. You know, we knew what was going to come because people, frankly, don't like change, and for good reason. You know, the voice of a certain event is enormously important, and Phil's voice has been people's summers. Eventually, though, you know, every voice in any sport goes away and is replaced by another one, and I think it jars with people. And I was fully expecting what we got, actually, for the first couple of days, where people tuned in to the one bike race they watch in the year and heard two different voices and, you know, instantly didn't like it to a large extent, and let us know. You know, it was remarkable how it's a long old month and people get used to it very quickly. And
do you enjoy it, though, commentary?
I love it.
Is it something that you were initially quite reluctant
very
to try?
Yeah, very, because for all those reasons, you know, one, I'm not Phil Liggett. Two, it's technical, and it's and I think it required a degree of immersion in the nuts and bolts, the detail of the sport that hadn't been required of me before that. Because as a reporter or presenter, you always have time to think about. You always have that time to think. Well, he's the rider who, but in, you know, actually, when it's the event is happening live in front of you, you've got a split second, and you've got to be right.
What do you love about it? Is it because there's that adrenaline aspect to it, or?
Yeah, it's like watching a race. It forces me to watch a race in super high definition, you know, in a way that I've never done before. Mm. When you are on the edge of your seat for 5 hours, sometimes we're doing the whole stage from start to finish, you know, 5 hours of the most intense concentration, where you're not just watching the screen and kind of in a slightly disengaged sort of way, which I realised I had been doing previously, if you're watching sort of Moto, let's say you're watching Moto 2 and that head-on shot of the bunch, actually you're not really looking at the first two riders in the line. You're trying to figure out what's happening in 12th or 13th position all the time, and you're trying to spot which team might be grouping and come. You know, so there's always stuff happening, even in the bald spots and the flat areas of a stage. There is always stuff going on, and it's being tuned into that kind of detail that made me appreciate. I think has made me appreciate cycling in the company of David, who's brilliant at getting all that across. For the first time, properly, actually.
So when you watch it, and you weren't at the World Championships recently, but you presumably watched the road race, do you, when you're watching it now, are you understanding it in a different way as well?
Completely. Completely. I mean, I think I'm understanding it for the first time, you know, at a different level. And it's very, very... And I go back to that point I was making about how rewarding cycling is as a sport, despite all its problems, and how many levels it has you can plumb down into. Because there's nothing wrong with just watching it with a small W. You know, you can do that, and you can do what lots of people do and watch the Alps come into view and just enjoy the city. That's a perfectly valid experience, and at one level, totally satisfying. But you can also drill deeper if you want.
One of the things I think that happens when you do watch it or try to watch it like that is that you start to appreciate the contributions of some of the lesser known riders.
Yeah.
Is there a rider this year that you've been struck by or noticed that you perhaps wouldn't have noticed in the past?
Oh, any number, really. There's a young rider, Valerio Conti, from Lampre Merida, who...
Pedler de Charme at the Giro.
Was he?
So he was noticed by us.
So stage four, he's kind of set up that win for Diego Ulissi, yeah, into that dreadful seaside resort down in Calabria. So it's contributions like that that hitherto I probably wouldn't have taken much attention. And then what's very good is then that you kind of like internally you mark a card, and actually physically I mark a card because I've built up a library of notes. And then to see that kind of thing repeated again, I think, on the Vuelta, where he was brilliant again, and say, yes, well, I kind of knew that about him. I'd seen him about that, and that's what he does. And, you know, and to build up a kind of, it's like those, do you remember those, those kind of pixelated paintings that were very popular in the 1980s, that if you kind of step away from and cross your eyes, a 3D image kind of magically hones into view, but it's actually quite difficult to capture that 3D image. It's a bit like that, I think, and each rider's contribution becomes part of those pixels. So I've enjoyed that, yeah.
Magic eye picture, yeah, a good analogy, a very good analogy. That seaside resort down in Calabria was actually quite nice, wasn't it, Rich? We had a lovely lunch there, and the evening meal we had some very lightly grilled tuna. That is a very good question.
It was quite a nice resort. It's just that our accommodation, we were in there for two nights, was beyond the pale. Beyond the pale.
Yeah, of course, because you were commentating on the Giro for...
With Dan Lloyd.
For the World Feed put out by the organisers, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
The experience of being on the road following two of the Grand Tours and doing another one, I don't think it's any secret.
From London,
doing the Vuelta from London. Do you think as a commentator you get more from actually being on site than you do from watching?
Yeah. You do miss a lot by doing it off tube. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's actually off tube means by remote.
Picking up the lingo, isn't it? Getting the lingo.
But you do, it's a nice life, actually, just commentating in the afternoon in London, then going home. And you don't have 200, 300 kilometre transfers every day. But you do miss detail. And David Miller and I, for example, on the Tour de France, I had folding bikes with us every day. And most days we would ride, even if it wasn't a mountaintop finish, riding in Cherbourg up that very, very complicated, kind of lumpy final 5 or 6K. We did that, and it gave us a much better appreciation of... And the road book only tells you so much. So that was very important. Or narrowing in the road. You know, again, these are things that I wouldn't have paid too much attention to before I was commentating. But, you know, the effect that when the road goes from two lanes to one, the effect that can have on a race is just sometimes everything, isn't it? And to build up that picture by actually getting out there and seeing it is vital.
What about other races, though? I mean, I mentioned you've been on the road a lot and been to some pretty obscure races. Any that you particularly enjoyed? Or
two ends of the spectrum would be this time last year, actually, I went to cover, I think, the worst bicycle race I've ever been to, the Tour of Taihu Lake, which is nine stages that were basically flat circuit races around these vast Chinese cities, most of which house 6 million people, and you've never heard of any of them. You know, it's just an extraordinary part of China, flat as a pancake, grey, nobody cared. And there were no people there, apart from the odd group that had been compulsorily placed at the
finish line.
We're
going to get complaints, aren't we, from Chinese cycling fans? No, already
complain all their life.
Well, for
nobody cared. And but yet, that didn't stop the organisation, the people who own the race, using public funds to buy in some of the best experts, not myself, obviously, but the best expertise they could get from Europe. So all the French France Télévisions moto pilots and helicopter pilots, they had a Tour de France spec on the race, and nobody cared. Jakub Moretzko won 7 of the 9 stages. 7 of the 9.
Up-and-coming rider. One to watch.
Yeah, that's what I kept saying all year, and then he did precisely nothing. Apart from pipping Elia Viviani to that win, do you remember, in the Italian jersey, right back at the beginning of the year, Tour de San Luis, and Viviani spat his dummy out and wouldn't go onto the podium.
That's right, yeah. And so at the other end of the spectrum, what's the...
Another spectrum. Lots of people care, and it's beautiful, and it's quite a hipster race. The Arctic Race of Norway. Mm. That was a privilege to go to that race. It crisscrossed the Arctic Circle in August. And Norway's one of those places that has to be seen to be believed, actually. If you just see a photograph or some video of Norwegian hills, you go, yeah, all right, you know, it's a bit like Scotland or whatever. But actually, it isn't, because when you get there, everything's 5 times bigger and emptier than you could imagine. And it's just incredible. And all the riders, you can tell when the riders kind of love being at a race as well. And they're just chilled, and you know, produce some good racing and lovely. And the people up there, and they do love. And also, Norway, how good are Norway with their kids coming through and everything? They've got a bunch of really, really good riders now.
One of the things, I mean, in your previous role as a reporter, you're obviously having a lot of contact with the riders. Is that something that you can still manage as a commentator? Is that something you miss a little bit?
That's a bit tricky, actually, because I do miss that. It's very important that you know, especially with riders I don't know much about, that I can spend 10 minutes with them informally in a hotel lobby and just get a bit of background that doesn't exist. It's hard to research without talking to them face-to-face. What I find a little bit difficult, and I think Miller is probably struggling with equally, is then, you know, on the occasions in which you're called upon, which do arise, to be critical or to put a rider's performance into some sort of context, which occasionally you have to do. I think that's ultimately going to be difficult to, you know, maintain some of your closer ties to some of the riders.
Is it difficult or is it easier if you don't have...
Well, again, that's what I'm saying. So perhaps with some of those riders who I knew quite well, and perhaps I have a bit more distance now, so that I can say what I sometimes need to say, you know, without a friendship issue or a closer relationship clouding that's part of my job.
Without one of their friends or followers on Twitter telling them what you've just said and copying them in and then a whole Twitter storm blowing up around
your commentary. It happens. I mean, not often publicly, but, you know, messages are sent. And people, they are, not all, but plenty of riders are peculiarly thin-skinned. And often they themselves haven't heard what it is. So there's, again, a Chinese whispers, you know, a relative will pass it on that, oh, he said this. And, that, you know, by the time it's actually relayed back to you with a few expletives.
You've just called them the worst rider in the history of time.
Exactly. Whereas in fact, all you said was something perfectly legitimate that it maybe was fair enough, you know. So that's a bit tough.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much to Rafa for their continued support of the podcast. We're going to be doing an event in association with Rafa before the end of the year. Details will be forthcoming very soon, if they haven't been forthcoming already, because we're talking 2 weeks before this is being broadcast.
Oh, we are. And, I mean, we've got to rename it, because we were going to call it Bikeology, weren't we? But
were you?
No, we weren't really.
That's just a
little... A little gagette there. we're doing a Rafa event. We might have something for our fans north of the border.
We might, well, unconfirmed as yet. But it may be confirmed by the time this is broadcast. It's really confusing.
We could have me sort of voicing over at this point now if these events are confirmed. Maybe we'll slot that in here now.
We've got a couple of events coming up in a few weeks. On Wednesday, November the 30th, we'll be at Rafa London in Brewer Street. Richard, Daniel and I will be joined by Cannondale Drapac manager Jonathan Vorters and French journalist Francois Tomazo to discuss what the future of professional cycling has in store. Tickets are free. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events for details. If you're quick, you may also be able to get a ticket for our event at the Signet Library in Edinburgh on Thursday, December the 1st. That will feature Richard, me and Francois go to the same website, thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events for details of how to buy tickets for that one.
It'll be seamless, I'm sure. Lionel in his kitchen as opposed to Lionel in the National Theatre where we are currently. And where we were spotted earlier by a friend of the podcast who tweeted a picture of us. Really put you off your game, didn't it, Lionel?
Dude, I wasn't breathing in, you see. you know, in public I like to breathe in before I'm photographed. Put on a bit of Jan Ullrich style off season timber, I noticed this morning when I
still doing your training.
Really? I think we should both be inspired by Ned. You know, lost those 10 kilos, did you say?
Probably was, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
God. Fine example. We're kind of going the other way, aren't we, Lionel?
I certainly am, unfortunately. Back on the bike next week, which is last week if you're listening to this, so hopefully it's going really well.
We should do another one of those long, grotesquely unpleasant winter rides that
You got me at a bad moment there. I was very unfit at that particular point.
Do you remember our encounter with that Jehovah's Witness?
Yeah.
In
a little village.
Eastwood. Home of D.H. Lawrence.
People could go back and listen to that podcast, in fact, couldn't they? It's from 2014, from November 2014.
You want to hear three men very out of breath?
Well,
it was fun, though.
We rode from Nottingham to Manchester. Richard, you were spotted numerous times holding onto a vehicle on the climbs. I actually cut out one of the climbs. Ned was the only one who made it all the way from Nottingham to Manchester
was a terrible guy.
I remember you punctured within about a mile of us setting off.
I did.
And then you had to go find a branch to Halford somewhere.
I did. I had to buy a new tyre and get it all fitted. It was.
But you could tell that Ned was somebody who rides a lot on his own, couldn't you?
Yeah, no one likes me.
Yeah, head down, half wheeling, just putting you in difficulty when you're trying to answer his questions.
Yeah.
You know, conversation was...
Nobody likes a half wheeler, do they?
Do you know what's amazing? I was, a couple of weeks ago, I was with a travel company who sponsor the show, Exodus Travels. Since we're all plugging stuff, thank you very much.
Hang on, they don't sponsor our show. We'll edit that bit out.
this travel company took me to Mont Ventoux, and we just spent 3 days with some prize riding up Mont Ventoux, and it was quite hard because it's quite a long mountain, and you get to the top and you're pretty tired. And we got to the airport after 3 days, quite pleased with ourselves. And this other chap, unrelated to our group, was sat there, British bloke with a bike box next to him, who said. He said, you ridden up Mont Ventoux? He said, well, I said, yeah, a couple of times, actually. And he said, yeah, I did it 6 times in one day.
Wow.
Well, you know someone who did it even more, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I rode it in June, just the once.
Which way?
For one of our Friends of the Podcast special episodes about the myth and the magic and the mystery of Mont Ventoux. I think that episode is called Heat, Wind and Fear.
Nice.
And it's available to listen to. It's part of the 2016 Friends of the Podcast package. But yeah, I rode it. I told some stories about the history of the mountain and of bike races that have happened on the mountain. And one of the contributors is a musician called James Welsh, who writes music under the pseudonym Camera. And he was inspired to write a whole album of music based on having been to ride Mont Ventoux 5 times a day for 5 days, I think it was. Well, it might have been 5 times a day for 4 days. Either way, it was riding up there a lot, repeatedly. And it was so hot for them that they were starting their first ride at sort of 2 in the morning so they could get a couple of rides in before the sun was really, really strong. But, you know, an absolutely phenomenal... Have you ridden it before, Ned? Before?
Yeah, a few times. I rode it up on the Brompton, actually.
Oh, of course,
But but yeah, I had. But yeah, once in a day, that's enough, isn't it? Like, just these people who can do it multiple times, it's absolutely breathtaking. It's because it's hard.
It's a real beautiful.
But I presume because you were doing a lot of history, you rode through Bedouin and up that way, Chateau-Renard.
Yeah.
What's odd about that climb is you do an awful lot of climbing, especially at our pace. That you can't really see the mountain you get no reward. You're just climbing through the forest, so you don't. There's no switchbacks over which you can look and say, "Huh, I've climbed all the way up from the valley floor to here." To motivate you halfway up, you'd have no conception of how far you've come until you get past Chateau-Renard and the mountain opens up, and then you go, "Good God, I'm halfway to the moon."
And then the last bit is just breathtaking, really, isn't it? Because you can't take your eyes off the summit.
Yeah.
It really is a mountain of... It's not quite halves, is it? Because the forest section's a lot longer.
Yep.
But I lost my rag with that forest section, as people will hear in the episode. It was just... Yeah, it was just annoying. Just annoying.
Swearing.
Anyway.
Angry Lionel. Ned, you're on the eve of your Grand Départ. Are you nervous?
I am very nervous.
You are. You've been nervous for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, it's. But I like new challenges. You know, it was. But this is a bit. It's a bit different.
Do you have a warm up act?
Hey,
do you have a warm up?
I am the warm up act.
We could have been the support act, couldn't we, Lionel?
Yeah.
I don't know if we'd like being on your undercard.
How have you gone about it, though, Ned? Have you written the show and then commit it to memory, or is there a certain amount of...
It's structured but improvised.
You got so it written I kind
of
on your
know
hand.
What I kind of yeah I know what's coming next in theory, but the words that fly out of my mouth are the words that fly out of my mouth.
So the first two could be a bit rough and ready.
Oh, that'll be horrendous.
You'll be in tears.
Bury St Edmunds and Chelmsford, but they'll be stinkers. They might be all right by the time I get to
the people coming to Bury St Edmunds.
They're going to have an awful time. They might be quite angry.
But by the time we get later in the run, you're looking to peak in the final third.
Oh, well, I'm doing a negative split. Right. I'm gonna like Quintana.
So by Clapham, it will be highly polished. It will be the Champs-Élysées of cycling stand-up shows.
No, I hope it's fun, and there's stuff that's going to happen on stage that I can't really say, actually, because it'd be a bit of a spoiler.
But how can people find out about it online and book tickets and all that thing?
There's a bicology.co.uk. That's it, and that's got all the dates and the thing, and there we go.
Do let us know, listeners, if you go along, what you think. Give us your feedback.
No, don't do that. It's fine. It's a waste of time. Just crack on with your jobs and don't worry.
Don't spoil it. We're going on the last night, we don't want it spoiled, do we?
True. I'm sure people will let you know if they've had a good time or not, Ned.
Yeah, I'm sure they
But I'm
will.
Sure, you know, fans sure of will. Ned Bolting will be the people who come along to it. So, well, you know, fans of your writing
and dreadful
your
if they weren't.
Commentating.
Have an awful time. Yeah.
Is there a blazer badge and tie set available in the foyer? That's what I want to know.
No, but books are available in the foyer to purchase, including my latest, which is out on the 20th.
Which is called?
Which is already out now because it's all pre-recorded. Bolting's Velosaurus, which is a bit fun. For anyone who remembers the meaning of lif, right, from back in Douglas Adams, back in the 80s, it's kind of a bit like that.
So
I've done lots of mainstream. I've done lots of mainstream interviews to try and publicise this, and I don't think a single one of them have understood that everything in the book is a nonsense. So it's been really hard.
I asked Ned if he'd be willing to read out some of the entries from the book, and he said it works better on the page. He said, but I did just open it on a funny entry.
Oh God!
Gramophone. A rider who talks incessantly about weight.
There we go.
That's quite good.
That's very good. Oh, well, it works on at least two levels. I've counted there. That's excellent.
Can I read you one?
Yeah, of course.
I want to read you the special. Okay.
No, I'm just it's good. It's good.
Okay.
As I'm chuckling as I flick past the pages.
I just want to read you the story of special, which is translates loosely as the special one, I suppose. I've bookmarked it here. Special, which is a masculine noun. An oddity, a unique rider, an outsider, the special one. The most celebrated special of modern times was the Uzbek sprinter Ruslan Ablamatov, who had been reared, so it was claimed, on the scrubland surrounding a defunct Soviet missile silo in a Karalakbakstan region close to the Uzbek border. His father, Vitaly, a decorated Red Army major who disappeared shortly after the Moscow Olympics, had ended up living in the silo where he raised his son in a makeshift wigwam erected inside the abandoned missile control centre. Brought up by his taciturn father, the identity of Ablamatov's mother was never established, who continued to guard the silo against enemy aggressors, the young Ablamatov grew up increasingly restless. While his father kept watch for endlessly long shifts, Ruslan roamed further and further from home, exploring the semi-arid plains that stretched to the horizon until one day he disappeared altogether. For more than 7 years, he was lost to the world. One day, in the early summer of 1993, he resurfaced, riding a rusty rally chopper on the outskirts of the town of Munyak, accompanied by a pack of wild dogs. When the local police were called, the dogs withdrew into the steppe, snarling, and Ablamatov was taken off for questioning. He revealed next to nothing about his missing years, even when interrogated by the same team of experts in Moscow who had deciphered the strange howling language of the wolf girl of Kropotkin. Though he retained language from his early childhood, his vocabulary was restricted to only about 7 words, quote, most of which related in some way to bicycle racing. Ablamatov remained something of a mystery. An art house documentary was made by the St. Petersburg Institute of Fine Arts about his rehabilitation, and it briefly found favour with Moscow's emerging post-Glasnost intelligentsia. It featured repeated close-up footage of Ablamatov's teeth, intercut with shots from an early edition of Paris-Roubaix set to a soundtrack from the Pixies. 2 years... 2 years later, his case was featured in the United Kingdom in an episode of Channel 5's Famous Freaks. But it wasn't until Ablamatov underwent a series of physiological tests at the Moscow Sports Academy that his obvious talent for cycling became apparent. Tested on the Krylyatskoye track, I think that's how you pronounce it, he rode three times around the 333-metre circuit, banking at lightning speed, breaking all records, before abruptly leaving down the ramp, riding his bike along the corridor and out of the building. And for a further period of 7 years, he disappeared again without a trace. The next anyone saw of him was at a low-key press conference in the south of France. In 2011, he signed for Marseille La Pomme and won the Grand Trophée d'Armagnac in his first season. In 2013, after his son made his debut in the Tour de France, a dishevelled and tearful Vitaly Ablamatov was arrested in Tashkent, where he had presented himself at the French embassy demanding to be flown that night by helicopter to Pau. He was eventually convicted of attempting to smuggle meat products and failure to pay parking fines going back 20 years. Ruslan Ablamatov continues to ride for Lampre Merida and recently won a stage of the Tour of Britain into Stoke-on-Trent. That's one of the longer entries. That's
brilliant.
I think we found one of the subjects for our Friends of the Podcast specials next year.
Yeah, let's just play that. Listen, that we should wrap things up, but that's a fine note to end it on. Thank you very much, Ned, for joining us. And best of luck with the show.
You're going
to
love it.
Yeah, it's not the thing to say to a cyclist, but break a leg.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Continuing a recent tradition of the Cycling Podcast, this is an addendum to this week's episode, because we recorded with Ned Bolting now about 10 days ago, before he set out on his tour. I've caught up with him at the London Velodrome, where we're at the London 6 Day. Ned's working here, but you are now mid-tour. How have the first few dates gone?
It's been absolutely brilliant. I've loved it. It's been completely terrifying. Quite big venues. I mean, you know, sort of 500-seat theatres, and without blowing trumpets or anything, just most of them are quite close to being sold out, and that's terrifying. So pacing up and down in your dressing room all on your own, waiting to get going, is nowhere, it's nothing like any of the rest of my work. It's complete, mind-numbingly frightening. But when you get up on stage and the first gag kind of works, it's brilliant. I've really enjoyed it. Walking through this, a bit of a cliche, isn't it? You kind of leave your dressing room and walk through these weird tunnels up onto the stage and the bright lights and everything. But you walk past all these provincial theatres. You walk past these framed pictures of all the people who've appeared there before, like Elkie Brooks and Ken Dodd. Literally.
Ned, what have you got in your dressing room? Have you got a rider?
Fruit and mineral water.
Stale pear.
Fruit and mineral water, mate.
M&M's, do you specify a colour?
Fruit and mineral water. I am doing this on fruit and mineral water. Well,
anyone who's got tickets for future shows, they've heard there how important it is it gets a good response to the first gag. So if you can maybe get together and greet it with a stony silence, just to test them. He has described the venues as provincial theatres after all.
The first gag is visual. So don't ask me to tell you what the first gag is. It's a visual gag, but it relates in some way to recent events in cycling.
Intriguing. Well, that's good though. It's good you're enjoying it, and you'll be polishing it for the final one in Clapham, which I'm going to come along to, which is quite a way away.
Yeah, I'm worried about that. There's a lot of people I know coming to Clapham, and London audiences are horrible, you know, with their metropolitan ways and their world weariness. Dreadful people.
Definitely going to try and give you a tough time, a bit heckling there. Well, that's great, Ned, that it's going so well. In the meantime, thanks very much, Ned, and enjoy the rest of the 160.
Thanks very much, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.